This Two Lectures episode features advisor, author and founder of Two Lings, Ling Ling Fung, recorded live at the global event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2019.
My journey here today into this cowshed in Wales started back in 1979 in an onion truck. My brother was 3 years old and I was 18 months old. It was the middle of the night and they told us to be really quiet so we wouldn't be caught at the checkpoint. Who has kids that age, 3 and 18 months old, or has had them? Okay. What is the likelihood that they would be quiet when you told them to do so? The Vietnam War ended with the fall of Saigon in 1975. This was 4 years prior to my family hiding in an onion truck on the way to the harbor. My father fought in the Vietnam War for 15 years alongside the American troops. It was a war about ideologies against the communist North and the democratic South. About 3.8 million people died in that war, and about $1 trillion in today's terms were spent on it. But to say that the war was unpopular is just a huge understatement given the number of, you know, songs written against it. For my father, he lost most of his friends in the battlefield, but he came out alive with 3 bullet wounds and a host of memories he would never share with us. So a top tip for Friday: if you're gonna fight in a war, try not to be on the losing side. Although I think at the end of the war, there are no winners. To give you some context as to why we were hiding in an onion truck, the aftermath of the war for those that fought on the South Vietnamese side, the losing side, was devastating. My father went into hiding house to house to avoid getting into a forced labor camp where you would get re-educated. But this kind of education is without books. A lot of his friends went in there, and sometimes just for a few days, sometimes for over a decade, but faced starvation, torture, and forced labor. So my parents discussed night after night, do we stay, do we go? Should my dad go first and then come back for us? And then they looked at us. We were 3 years old and 18 months old, and they said, wow, what kind of future would these two kids have? Losing your life is only one way of dying. So my family decided to go and decided we would go together, we would live together, or we would die together. It costs 8 bars of gold per person. That's $4,000 per person. For our family, it was 32 bars of gold, or $16,000. Now, back in 1979, after the war in Vietnam, GDP per capita was well under $200. In today's terms, it cost $60,000. My parents liquidated everything they had, which after war was not very much, and they borrowed the rest. So my brother was 3 years old and I was 18 months old, and somehow inside us, we knew to be quiet. Because there were other families in that truck too, and if we had said anything or made a peep, we would have all been caught. We didn't know, but somehow we did know, that it would be the journey that would change our lives forever. So we made it to the harbor. And we boarded a boat that was 3 by 19 meters, 2 levels. It held 300 people in it. Actually, by the time we arrived to Hong Kong, after 3 days in the open water, there was 301, because a woman gave birth in those 3 days. During that time, about 2 million people fled Vietnam after the war, but only about 800,000 people survived. And people died because of drowning, they died because of disease, they died because of starvation, and some died by the hands of pirates as well. And so, you know, you've not met my parents. My parents are lovely people. They are people that get really nervous just driving across town to a new grocery store. So then you wonder, like, how did you ever make that decision? You know, how did you make the decision to get on this little boat and leave your country forever and risk all of our lives? I'm sure you've seen photos like this recently about the refugee crisis. And people ask, how could anyone do this? How could anyone put their child on a boat to die? Well, it's the same thing my parents did. It's the same force that compelled Alan Kurd's family and Oscar and Valeria's mother to put their children on boats. My parents did not do this for themselves to better their own lives, because, you know, actually being American citizens is great, but they just reap a fraction of that benefit as compared to my brother and me. They did it for a chance for their two small children to have better lives. And that's why every parent does this. It's an act of pure love. Today, there are over 70 million refugees searching for a safe harbor. This is the same journey that my family made 40 years ago. This year is the 40th anniversary of us fleeing and arriving safely in America. So after 3 days in open water, we arrived to the refugee camp in Hong Kong. It took 7 days for us to get permission to disembark. And you know, when we got permission, my mom was so excited. And she said, oh, I want to have us look presentable. So she took off our shoes, and she strung them up on a rope, and she dangled it over the boat into the ocean to wash them off. And you can imagine what happened. A big wave came through and took all of our shoes away. So, you know, in her efforts to make us look, you know, better, we actually walked off the boat barefoot, looking more destitute than before. And these are photos of my brother and I, actually, like, literally fresh off the boat. I look like a criminal. They didn't even give us a shower or anything. They were just tagging us. So we stayed in the refugee camp for 6 months in Hong Kong. And I was too young to remember any of this, but my brother, who was just old enough to remember, just tells me about the long lines, the endless long lines, waiting. Told me about his favorite day where our dad bought him a sun-kissed orange soda. My mom, during this time, ever the entrepreneur, when she saw that people had a bit more money, she would make sticky rice and cake and she would sell it. When she saw that people had a little bit less money in the camp, she would make yams because it was a bit more affordable. So my mother's never been educated, and she's actually still illiterate today, but somehow she figured out how to keep us all alive selling lemon sponge cakes baked in a paper cone. You know, people that are illiterate, actually, they're pretty incredible because they actually have to memorize everything. Imagine if you couldn't write down a grocery list or, you know, a birthday. So we owe quite a lot of our lives to this woman who has had no education and in some respects would never be looked upon as successful, but she is my hero. So after 6 months, we were sponsored by an Episcopalian church in a rural town in Virginia. We were a community service project. Warrenton, Virginia is about 60 miles southwest of DC, and during that time, only about 1,000 people lived there. It was surrounded by dairy farms. The next 20 years of our lives is the classic immigrant's tale, but you know, I wanna say right now that I'm so grateful for that community for opening up the doors and welcoming us and letting us rebuild our lives, because there's nowhere to go back to. You know, you hear sometimes now in the dialogue about refugees, like, why don't you go back home, and how absolutely ridiculous that is. So I'm so grateful for the community that opened the doors to us back then 40 years ago. So classic immigrant tale, and I think probably any of you who have immigrant parents or probably know the story. My parents worked 3 jobs each, not an exaggeration, worked as janitorial staff, cleaning, laundry staff as well too. They worked at a hospital, elementary school, nursing home during the day. In the evenings, they worked at law offices and accounting offices and insurance offices and cleaned at night. They worked for 20 years without taking a day off, even on the weekends. It wasn't until my brother and I went off to university they actually took the weekends off. And you know, when I was a kid during the summer, I was so jealous about people going off to summer vacation with their families, going off to the beach or, you know, going in a camper van and doing something fun like that. We ended up having our very first family vacation together about 9 years ago. We went to Key West, Florida, and here's a picture of my family, my wonderful sister-in-law, Stephanie, and my baby niece, Ellie. So the first half of my life is super dramatic, and I had absolutely no control over any of it, and I can claim really nothing for the success in being alive, actually, that I owe that all to my parents. And actually, the probability of me being here today in a cowshed in Wales talking to all of you wonderful people is zero, and I'm going to tell you, I'm going to show you just how. Let's take a look at the arc of my life so far in statistical terms. And I think everyone should do this so that you know just how special this moment is here today for you. That actually the probability of all of us being here is fairly magical. And I think that's what we're all feeling this weekend. I was born in 1977, 2 months premature in a developing country after a war with not enough incubators. And my entire body could fit into the palm of your hands. The probability of me living was only about 50%. Then there is this whole boat ride that happened about 18 months later, and there are, you know, some pirates, and we could have all drowned and all of that, but somehow, you know, it was about 60% of the people that made that voyage died, but we survived. So that brings the likelihood of me landing in Hong Kong, surviving a premature birth, to only about 20%. That's not very good. You know, growing up in a small town, everyone knows who you are. You know, growing up in a small rural town in Virginia, everyone knew we were poor, everyone knew where we came from. And I don't think anyone meant to do this, but I remember just feeling like, you know, when people talked to me, it was with a bit of hesitation on what was possible. It wasn't so much what they would say, but it was how they would say it, as if I were dumb, or as if I couldn't achieve very much. And maybe it's because my family, we all cleaned toilets, and we had, you know, sort of really blue-collar jobs, but that was sort of the sense and the feeling I got. And there's this one situation where my parents went into a shoe store to buy shoes for me, and the shopkeeper asked us to leave. They said we were too poor to afford anything there, so, you know, why serve us? One of the things that I've had to get over as an adult is that this idea that life is fair. Because actually, it isn't very fair. Life is many things. It's wonderful. It's magical. It can be many positive things, but fair it is not. We don't actually have to look very far to see that life is not fair. All you have to do is to go to a cancer ward in a children's hospital and realize that life is not fair. But I struggled with that because I felt what was injustices regularly, these small cuts, these small slights regularly. And so that feeling of like wanting things to be fair, and then at some point I realized if you just embrace it, that is just true, it's not fair, and then can you move on? And so you do, you move on. My parents kept us alive, both physically and spiritually. You know, so I had all of this mental talk of I'm not, you know, good enough and et cetera, with people looking at us in a particular way because we were poor. In 1999, I graduated from university. The probability of graduating from university, if you don't have any parents with higher level degrees, is about 25%. So that brings my existence at 21 years of age to about 5% of actually happening. Now, There's so much that I don't remember about those very early days when it was really dramatic. I don't remember the boat ride. I don't remember the refugee camp. But certain things have been imprinted on me since childhood. The first is the cold. I react very uncomfortably to the cold. And when I say cold, it's different. It's all relative. I have to actively feel warm, or I actually feel really cold, and I start shaking. Actually, it's a real visceral feeling. And I thought everyone felt like this, but actually, no. Moving to this country, I realized that it's not the same at all. And I think it might be because, you know, we left a tropical place in Vietnam, and we landed in December in Virginia in the middle of the winter. And you can imagine we did not pack winter coats into those suitcases. And we lived for a number of years in houses with probably very little heating. The second is I have a very funny relationship with food and hunger. A couple of dentists asked me before, when they checking my teeth, they said, "Hey, were you really ill as a child?" You know, because we see imprints of malnutrition. I'm like, "Oh boy, I will never tell my mother this." She never, ever, ever let us go hungry. But you see, malnutrition and hunger don't go together. You can actually feel full and be malnourished at the same time. But probably the most insidious one was that self-talk, that mental dialogue of, you know, I'm not good enough. You know, I had a chip on my shoulder. I wanted to prove all the time. And you know, when they say, oh, immigrants have this really great work ethic. But I don't think it has anything to do about ethics. I think when you're an immigrant, what you're trying to do is get out of where you are now. You need to lift up out of where you are now, and you want to take your family with you. In that pace of work, from a place of desperation, can deplete you and completely blind you to what is available in the world. But luckily, at a very young age, I actually learned to move from a very different place. Here's one of the first example. When I was a senior at William & Mary, I read in an article about a little boy who watched his grandmother get washed away in a mudslide. And, you know, I was overwhelmed with this sense of compassion. I didn't look at him and thought, oh my gosh, you know, I feel so bad for him. I saw him in me. We were the same, only we were in very different circumstances. And, you know, in senior year, I was really busy. I was working as a waitress 25 hours a week, and I was interviewing for jobs, and I was studying for exams. And at those times, it's like, you know, you read this and you think, oh, I should do something, and so easily you could walk away. And for the first time, I didn't walk away. I actually picked up the phone, called up the Red Cross, and I said, hey, can I help? But the Red Cross didn't have anything started then, and so I and another classmate started this relief effort. And something very magical happened. It was as if like something came over me and everything just came into a flow and there was time for everything. And it became the Red Cross's official relief effort in the Tidewater region and was the largest relief effort in the university that was about 311 years old then. Why this is important is because at that point I said, oh my gosh, I found my calling. I found a genuine call to service. But who here has parents who are Asian or immigrant parents? Raise your hand. Okay. Is it okay to take a job in charity? And the answer is typically no, because if you have Asian parents, there are only two possible jobs, and job number one is being a doctor, and job number two is being a lawyer. And if you can't do job number one or two, you should amass great wealth. So those are really your only options. And I say this in jest, but really I was quite torn because I felt a calling and I wanted to work in the charity sector. But at the same time, I didn't want to turn my back on my family who actually gave me everything in the life that I had today. So another pivotal moment was when I actually went to Senegal. I had to actually, during this period after university, I couldn't just take a job in charity. I actually went into commercial consulting and worked there, but I looked for opportunities to do work that was of meaning. And so I went to Senegal, I worked for a women's credit union, I started a school lunch program with two other scholars there that feed about 150 children. And I was able to really, you know, match the two as best I could. And then when I came out of Senegal, I realized that I needed to retool because the challenges I saw there, you know, a big heart is wonderful, but it deserved actually much more rigor. So in 2008, I graduated with an MBA from MIT and an MPA in international development from Harvard. And you can imagine how proud my parents were at this graduation ceremony. So I'm going to go a little bit faster now because I don't have too much more time, just about a minute. Okay, so I graduated with dual master's degrees at Ivy League colleges, so that brings the probability of me living in 2008 to not 0.5%. Now, when I moved to the UK, I set up a business, actually ending up being able to do exactly what I felt I was brought on this earth to do. I had spent a number of years working in business advising in, you know, a commercial level. And so when I moved here, I decided, well, I'm going to do advising for businesses, but I'm actually going to bring purpose into the core of it. So for the last 10 years, I've been running my own business, advising large corporations to build new ventures to solve some social or environmental challenge in the world. That work has taken me all over the world, into the Africa region and Asia. I worked on awesome projects, such as a product to prevent malnutrition, a safe drinking water project, and also tools to help small micro entrepreneurs do their businesses better. So the probability of actually, you know, running a successful business is only about half, and so that brings the figure down to 0.3. And then if you calculate actually being invited to come here to speak, really, the probability is about 0%. So to overcome this, I mean, to wrap this up, you know, this is really about overcoming probabilities with love. And you can see that it's an ode to my parents, because in the first half of my life, the probabilities of me surviving were actually really quite low, surviving and thriving. And it was really due to their love that my brother and I were able to make it and be good contributing human beings now. And the second half, actually, I have to say, is from the great fortune of realizing what it is to do work with purpose. And that now I get to do really awesome social innovation, a bunch of stuff with extraordinarily low probabilities, but I get to do it with the greatest love. So.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.